Welcome to the Inner Ho Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black polyamorous feminist hoe living in New York City.
And it's Akua, one intersectional feminist hoe who specializes in all things mental health and care for you black girl.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, my name is Sam. I'm the principal host of this hair show. That means that week in and week out, I'm here with one of three rotating co-hosts. And this week we have name...
Akua!
Didn't write your name. And I don't know who you are. And then on week four, we all come together for a joint episode. Or this week, we're actually doing our joint episode next week. We're switching around because Rob's leaving us. But that should be a pretty cool episode. But this episode will also be a pretty cool episode.
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to season four of the fucking Inner Ho Uprising. Drop mic. If you're a listener to the show, we have a couple of segments for you. They are
Bae of the Week,
where we talk about people who we find attractive.
Ho of the Week,
where we talk about you guys, the homies, the listeners, the fans.
Self-care tip of the week.
Where we give you guys some advice on how to take care of yourselves.
Pay a ho.
Where we beg for money because we desperately need it.
F that.
Our current events segment, which we're not doing this week because we are doing a very special Black Panther episode. I'm sorry. We are doing a very special Black History Month episode.
Yes. F it.
Which is where we have our discussion on the topic of the day. And today we are talking about women of the Black Panther Party.
Yes.
Now, I realize that by the time this drops, the film Black Panther comes out a day after. That was by accident. There was no, yeah, that's a mere coincidence. So this has nothing to do with the film Black Panther. Sorry, guys. We all understand that you're very excited, but this doesn't have anything to do with that.
About the movie.
Yeah, and nor does the original comic have anything to do with the Black Panther Party. Yeah, it actually was created before the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
F me.
Which is the segment where we talk about our sexual, romantic, and dating lives, which we're also skipping because BHM.
And F you.
F you, because we're not talking about you. That's the time where we usually talk about you. But yes, shortened episode, Black History Month, cool things happening. What are the hashtags?
So if you guys would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, y'all can do so by using the hashtag Inner Ho Uprising so we can see it, and the hashtag Pod In so other people can see it.
Yay. What's our first segment?
Bae of the Week.
And what are we doing this month for Bae of the Week?
We... This sounds like when a teacher's trying to spoon answers out of you. And so it's just like a question and then a follow-up question, just inching the information.
All right, now
out
say
of
it. Say it. You can do it.
So our first segment is Bae of the Week. And in fashion with our Black History Month series, we are choosing a historic Bae of the Week.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your preferably bae? Black.
It really has to be, right? Like, you really can't come up in here. Thomas Jefferson.
Exactly.
Like, who the fuck?
Abraham Lincoln. He freed the slaves.
Like, yikes, man.
So my Bae of the Week is actually tied into the little special treat we gave you guys, let's say like about a week ago.
Cool.
When we went live on our Instagram and we live broadcasted an urban burlesque show.
Mm-hmm.
So in that fashion, my Bae of the Week is Lottie the Body Graves.
Sounds like a bad beach.
Click the link. She was.
Okay.
She's still alive, so she is. Hell, give her her dues.
Oh, she is bad.
Yes.
She's still alive?
Yes. She's 85 now, 80 something.
That's a sugar mama to me.
All right. So this was quoted. You see, she's a bad bitch. Mm-hmm. This was quoted almost every
look at her
article.
Now, though. Like,
she's
hey,
my
honey.
Grandma. It's lovely. Because us women, we can be so multidimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Our lives. We
yes.
can do everything and anything
yes.
in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So she was Lottie the Body back in the 60s. And now she's grandma. I don't know her real name. Lottie. Grandma.
But just
Lottie,
remember, yeah. like, your grandma probably was a bad bitch, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's okay. Your grandma had sex. That's okay. So did my Angela.
Your grandma's like, the reason why you're here.
Exactly. Oh my God, is that her now?
I hope not.
What?
No,
what's
that's
happening?
Not.
Okay.
That's someone else. That is not her. Stop Googling things.
Akua said, I hope not, and I'm really just going to put my hands in my
So
my lap.
Many descriptions of her, and this was like her, I don't know. What's like a, like not like a signature, but like a phrase people always use about you. There's a name for it, I know.
A nickname?
No. So nonetheless, this phrase was always kind of accompanied with her. It goes, quote, she was built like a double order of pancakes, sweet and stacked. Nigga. What? Why don't people describe me like
That's
that?
That's actually what I was thinking, like, but I'm neither sweet nor stacked. I'm rude and sour.
Oh, yeah. You said that, and I just pictured a bowl of sauerkraut. Sam is a bowl That's of me. Sauerkraut.
Not pancakes.
So she was known as Detroit's answer to Gypsy Rose Lee, which was a white, famed American burlesque dancer. Mm-hmm. And the Motor City's most famous exotic dancer.
It's the Motor City, Detroit?
Yeah, Detroit. Mm-hmm. So she was born in the 1930s in South Carolina, but she has Bajan roots. Her parents were from Barbados.
Hey. Lie the Body is so much more attractive than Gypsy Lee Rose.
But you know,
not
white
to pit
people.
Women against each other, but like,
you know, white people, this? They love to give fame and props to mediocrity. So,
damn,
it is what it is.
Yeah.
Back to Lottie. She was classically trained in New York, lived in New York, and she began dancing at 17. She's well known for her techniques, which is quoted as just superior to her competitor. So she was just blowing bitches out the water.
Nice.
Her techniques was unmatched. Her techniques and her movements were unmatched. And I believe that it's because she infused a lot of Afro-Latin and Afro-Cuban movements and culture into her performances and into her her costumes. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing that, if you're grabbing from the culture and the roots, of course, these white people can't match up. Mm-hmm, they don't got it. Mm-hmm. They just don't got it. So she's traveled all across the U.S. She's most notable because her talents transgressed to white clubs. So she was performing in both black-owned and white-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. At a time.
Double coin.
Yeah, at a time where, you know, racial tensions were really high, segregation was a thing. Mm. So she may have been performing in venues where black people couldn't even enter.
Mm. Wow. Kind of similar to Josephine Baker.
Yes. Yeah, so she is famed and known alongside performers like Josephine Baker, Ada Overton Walker, and Tony Ellings. And she's performed with her renowned musicians such as B.B. King and Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. And of course, like other great black women of the world, nobody knows about her. So this is my shout out to Lottie, and she's Bay of the Week.
Yay, Lottie the Body. Yay. Can I not make the entire cast of Black Panther my Bay of the Week?
You sure the hell can.
Oh, yay. This is obviously a historical film. You know, they like sold out. No, they didn't sell out. They sold the most pre-sale tickets of any Marvel film ever.
Rightfully
so. That's history now. And they're all sexy. Orgy, please, guys. Call me. Contact me.
I saw a trailer in which a woman was fighting and she threw her wig. And I said, see...
This wait, what?
You have to find the trailer. I don't know. She's in a red dress and she's fighting men, and she literally took her wig off and threw it at one of the niggas she was fighting.
Oh, is that one of the Dora Milaje who did that?
I don't know. As she kicked the other woman, I wish
I definitely stopped watching these because I was like, I want to be surprised, and you have ruined another thing for me.
I'm sorry. It was too iconic for me. It literally changed my life watching that trailer. I was like, did she just throw her wig? Black people made this movie.
In classic Akua fashion.
Black people made this movie. I'm so excited. I'm even more excited than I was before after seeing that. I was just like, see.
It's going to be fucking great.
It's.
Yeah. Very excited. Go see Black Panther. Also self-care tip of the week. Ho of the week now. Whom are our hoes?
Our hoes of the week are the people that pay us.
Yeah. Pretty consistently.
Yes. It is Gustavo M., Alicia D.
Yes, Alicia D. It must be said every time.
Yeah, it has to. Destiny R., Alex R., Sydney C., Kim O., Albert at Sir Cupcake, and Victoria M.
Yes, thank you. And then also thank you to Jay from Tea with Queen and Jay podcast, who y'all niggas was really trying to be like, oh, Shirley Chisholm is not black out here. And Jay was like, watch this documentary.
Did I? Yes, and so I so appreciated
yes.
it.
Shirley Chisholm was a black out here. Mm. The documentary she was referring to was 72 Unbought and Unbossed, about Shirley Chisholm's campaign. Mm-hmm. Yeah. for president. Self-care tip of the week, color and doodle.
Yes, that's actually very effective for people who have high anxiety.
Nice. Thank you for that science. I just did it last night because I was really tired and my brain wasn't working anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was interviewing a really cool visual artist named Jessica Valoris, whose music has been featured on the show like in season one. And she's also like an Afrofuturist, and she has these little coloring books, literally they're little coloring books, called Dream Awake. And they're of her doodles, which are really well designed and stuff like that. And they're like very spacey and fun and geometric. And you just have at it. Mm-hmm. And it was like I had a very long weekend, but I couldn't sleep when I got home, but I also couldn't do anything with my mind. And I was like, I just need to reset it, reset. So sometimes I feel like coloring or doodling just like gets out the information that's in your brain or allows you to express yourself, but not always in these rigid ways. So like when you're at work, you're expected to produce all of this mental energy for a specific thing. But like coloring and doodling just kind of like lets you be free. Yeah. So. Very enjoyable. Do that.
Yes.
What's our next segment? Payaho. If you would like to help sustain the Inner Hoa Uprising podcast monetarily, you can do so by going to innerhoauprising.com and clicking the tab Payaho. You can also go directly to paypal.me/innerho. It'll take you to our PayPal as well. You can also buy merchandise on our website by clicking the merchandise tab, and you can use the sponsor codes that haven't been in this show in years. Like, it's been 65 years since we have a sponsor, so please pay us directly. But you can also use old sponsor codes to get free stuff, free stuff or cheap stuff on your end, and to help sponsors return to our show. You can also now support a hoe on a monthly basis by subscribing to us on Patreon and receive perks while you're doing it. This is an easy way to throw some dollars monthly towards the show because studios, transportation, and events ain't cheap. And as you can see, every episode is not sponsored. If you're able and you'd be so kind, you can visit our Patreon, which is patreon.com/innerhoauprising, and donate $2, which will give you access to private IHU gatherings like Rob's going away party, which is in a little less than a week now, a week and a half. And you will also receive our undying love and affection.
Yes.
And for the low price of $5 a month, you can get all or the high price. You know, let me not shit on people. If $5 a month is high for you, but you're still willing to do it, thank you so much. So for the simple price of $5 a month, you can get all that as well as access to some exclusive behind the scenes video content, perfect for people who want to see the uncut scenes from the live show and more. You can also donate less or more, like $1 a month, for example, to a zillion dollars a month, for example. Anything is appreciated. This is just a more consistent way to pay a hoe. Pretty much spending what you would at a vending machine, but only once a month, and to help your fave hoes. Also, if you would like to pay us or not pay us, because we're kind of interested in doing both, but to speak at your school or conference about sex positivity, black feminism, or other kinds of topics we discuss on the show, we would love to do so. So please, to book us, send a line to ihupodcast@gmail.com. And thank you to the people who have been sending us lines. Check us out in the future, standing on the corner of Jamaica Avenue. Yeah. Standing on Parsons and Archer, right outside of the E-train entrance. Like, who wants to talk to me? Yeah. So we're going to go into our first and only segment of this here episode, F It, which we're censoring because we have a professor on the line. All right, and this is our topic of the day segment. And today we're talking about women of the Black Panther Party and kind of gender as it exists within the Black Panther Party, or as it existed within the Black Panther Party. And we're here with a very special guest that we're excited to have on. Robin C. Spencer is a professional historian. She is Brooklyn bred with roots in the diaspora. She specializes in history of the Black Freedom Movement in the United States. And she is the author of The Revolution Has Come, Black Power, Gender, and the Black Panther Party in Oakland. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you.
Yes. So if we can kind of start the conversation, not with the Black Panther Party, but just about you as a Black woman historian and like kind of your journey with that. So I guess we can start with, in general, what was your inspiration to even become a historian in the first place?
Okay. Well, I took a course. I grew up in Brooklyn, as was mentioned, and I went to college at SUNY Binghamton, which is upstate New York, for those who don't know. And I took a course there called Women in Social Movements. And that in that course, I read Asada Shakur's autobiography, Asada, and it was mind-blowing to me. She talked about her upbringing. She grew up in the Bronx. She talked about just going back and forth from New York to the South where her parents and her grandparents were from. She talked about just going from being unconscious to being conscious. She talked about herself as a radical political actor, a leader, a revolutionary, how she made all of that happen. She talked about all the things she did and all the things that were done to her by the state. And it, for me, it was a mind-blowing book because I hadn't read anything like that before. So after I read that in that class, I just started reading Black Power, Civil Rights type era memoirs, and soon enough, I came to the end of that list of what the library had available. This was the days before the internet was widely, you know, available in its, you know, in the form that we're used to it today. So that was it. There was no Google. There was nowhere else to go. And I was like, wow, I can't believe there's nothing else. And I wanted something that would put all of these individual stories into a bigger picture and allow me to make these connections. So that was my inspiration. I really wanted to be the person to do that, to make those connections within and among and between all of these radical political actors and to be able to talk about in a systematic way, like what their impact was on the larger society. So I went off to grad school in history, and the rest is history.
And since then, what kinds of work have you been doing around the history of the Black freedom struggle?
Well, since then, I've come quite a long way. I do lots of things. I participate in community-based oral history projects, meaning that I try to identify people who are around today, just in our communities, who have done amazing revolutionary acts of bravery, I should say, who've suffered from violence against them as part of their activism, et cetera. So I do oral history projects on a grassroots basis. I'm a professional historian. I'm a professor of history at Lehman College in the Bronx, which means I offer classes on the Black Freedom Movement, on African-American women's history. I'm an author of books, articles, essays, online essays as well, always trying to encourage people to centralize women in the story of the Black Panther Party. And I've done work with teachers to help them bring women's history into the classroom. So since those, you know, beginnings, I've kind of developed different mechanisms to try to educate people on all levels, inside the classroom, outside the classroom, in community as well.
And you had mentioned that, like, a lot of your work deals with centering women in these conversations. What's the significance of doing so?
Well, I find that when we think about women's involvement in these movements, that it allows us to think about these movements differently. All of a sudden, we see what it means like to literally be a member of these organizations, to get up and get out there on a daily basis, that it becomes concrete in a way when you centralize women's voices. Also, I found that women's contribution as leaders and theorists to these movements, so certain ideals that women sourced, created with, originated, that putting those ideals out there helps people broaden the conception of what the movement is about. I find that centering women, all of a sudden we see children and parenting as part of the movement. All of a sudden we see sexuality as part of the movement. We see the interpersonal as part of the movement. And we see really that a lot of the organizations and entities that we think about and we imagine them in one way, when we think about women doing the very things that these organizations did, it's a more accurate picture, it's a more nuanced picture, and it allows us a different sense of what's possible and who are the leaders that we're waiting for today, right? I think there's always a sense of, where are the leaders? And when you learn about women in history, you learn that leader's right in the mirror, or the leader does not look perhaps the way you imagine. It might be that middle-aged woman. It might be that teenager over there. That leadership can come from women all across the spectrum of age, race, sexuality, et cetera. So it's really an exciting way of just painting with different colors and just getting a bolder picture.
And a part of the work that you do with Centering Women is activist work, correct?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, I'm involved in several activist initiatives. So one of the things I'm involved in is the political prisoner freedom movement, I can say. It's part of the larger movement against mass incarceration and against police violence, but with a particular emphasis on those political prisoners who were spotlighted, like Assata Shakur, and harassed, terrorized, imprisoned, unfairly brutalized while in prison, unfairly kept beyond their sentence and denied parole. Currently, all of the people who are incarcerated today who are under the category of political prisoners. So I do activist work around that, particularly the campaign of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was a former Black Panther radical journalist and activist in Philadelphia. I'm also involved in internationalist work, so I'm very interested in the ways in which settler colonialism in the United States has its mirror in settler colonialism in the Middle East, in particular the situation in Palestine. So I'm involved in raising awareness around that and amplifying Palestinian voices of resistance and, you know, being an ally in that struggle led by Palestinians for their own self-determination and freedom. And I'm also, I like to consider myself just a radical educator, which means that I'm always in teaching mode. I'm always trying to figure out ways to, you know, collectively educate people about the power of the Black Freedom Movement. What happened? What were the strategies and tactics? What were the successes and failures? How were structures of capitalism, imperialism, you know, disrupted or, you know, maybe even strengthened by some elements of the movement? How can we understand where we are today by looking into the past? So I'm always interested in figuring out activist ways to bring that conversation to the larger public.
And now as we transition into specifically talking about the Black Panther Party, just to note, like when you said it's important to look at the past to figure out where we're going in terms of the activism work that we do, why, if any reason, do you think that it's important to specifically look at the Black Panther Party?
Well, I think the Black Panther Party was unique in a couple of ways. One was their strength of organization. That's oftentimes not what people think about when they think about the Black Panther Party. But they were a well-oiled machine, which didn't mean that they didn't have organizational flaws and challenges within their organizational structure. However, they were able to support things like a nationwide and international newspaper being produced by people who are not graphic arts majors or journalism majors or anything like that. They developed a cadre of people with the skill set, and they develop an internal education mechanism to allow for the production of this newspaper that went not just around the country, but around the world as one of the most well-regarded alternative press. They're also, I think, important because of the way that they use art and imagery to create a cultural shift around language and possibility. So the Panthers, in a lot of ways, they used the art that appeared in their newspapers. They used the music that they produced. They used even their bodies and how they appeared in public. The rhetoric that they used was all meant to challenge people's imagination that there was another future that was not only possible, that people could work towards on a concrete basis. This made them very inspirational. They were not sort of selling a dream, one can say, but in their time period, they really were kind of manifesting alternative ways of being in society. and mobilizing people around that. So I think that's also something that makes them unique and important to look at. And the third part of it is that the Panthers were majority women for much of their existence, especially in their later years, where women played a key and pivotal role in the organization, at the forefront, creating strategies, executing them, serving on leadership bodies, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the Panthers, for those reasons, they're very important for us to look at today. And then the final thing I'll say is that they also were very internationalist. They had emulators from around the world. They had an international presence in Algeria. They spoke about the Vietnam War. They spoke about what was happening in Algeria, the fight against French colonial power. They really tried to not only create a revolution in the United States, but connect that to the larger world, what was going on. We're still finding that the story being told. There was just recently a movie about a little documentary about with footage of the Panthers in the Congo in the late 60s, early 70s. So really important to think about how the Panthers moved on this international stage.
If we can start kind of at the beginning of the story of the Black Panther Party and women's involvement. So at the very foundation of the Black Panther Party, when you had Newton and Seal, did they at all have women in mind in the creation and foundation of the party?
That's an excellent question. Now, they talked about, in their earliest speeches and things like that, they talked about, when they went out there and gave those speeches, they talked about brothers and sisters. They talked about, they imagined their rhetoric called up an audience that would include both men and women listening ears to what they were saying. Now, they also, in some ways, kind of fell into the trap of thinking about men as the protectors and providers, and women and children as sort of the recipients of male protection, which at that time, given the historic, historic violence that the Black family had faced, that paradigm appealed to some people, right? It was seen as a corrective to the absent male or the disempowered male within the household. The Panthers were unique in that they were able to eventually, because when women joined in the spring of 1967, they put themselves into those protector roles. Just because when they joined, when women began to join the organization, women, it wasn't that women were given protective roles. They were also armed according to the open carry laws at that time, which was legal, and they also were seen as protectors. So if the women are protecting, then what does it mean? So the Panthers, in a lot of ways, they created an image of strong Black womanhood. Panther women defined this for themselves, and they challenged the way women's strength and power was demonized as somehow emasculating or matriarchal or things like, and, you know, any of those words that were so common at the time in the social science. And instead, the Panthers, when they started out, even though initially they didn't have any women, it's not that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale went and knocked on doors and said, come on in, my sister. No, they went around to their friends, their male friends, and their comrades, and that was the initial core of people, you know, the little more than half a dozen people who initially became the Black Panther Party. However, as soon as growth happened, women were there, and they opened the door, those initial women, to many other women joining in Oakland, California, as well as around the country, eventually around the world. So it's important to think about, yes, the vision was different, perhaps, with Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, but when presented with alternatives, their vision expanded.
And what kinds of reasons or what kinds of things led to Black women joining the Black Panther Party in the first place? So like they weren't being directly outreached to, but they mm-hmm. saw the growth. So what kinds of things attracted them to joining the party?
Well, some of them talked about just wanting to be active. Imagine now, this is the time of the largest civil rights movement. This is not just something that Black people in Oakland are seeing on television. They're seeing it like in their city, in San Francisco. You have all sorts of sit-ins and protests in the Bay Area around don't eat where you can't work, and you know, the idea of Black people being not at the front of the restaurant but in the back, you know, in the kitchen doing the dirty work, never the waiters or anything like that. So there was a definite awareness of inequality in Oakland. And the women that joined were similar to the men that joined in that they were tired of the unequal education and the police brutality and the unequal treatment and all of that. They also talked about sometimes that they had gone down to the local competing organizations and sometimes had been a little turned off by what they found. So, for example, you have some women talking to me about wanting to go down to the Nation of Islam after being attracted there because of Malcolm X's popularity and checking it out and feeling like there was too much rigidity in how men and women were positioned within that organization and wanting something that felt a little freer. So I think the Panthers, by not really having a strong stance or like a known format as to how women were going to be brought into the organization, I think those things brought them in. And I think that they were attracted to the openness. They were attracted to the uniforms initially that were there. The fact that the Panthers and the uniforms helped, they seemed organized. They had a program. They had particular activities they did. And that made women feel like this was an organization that was structured, and that appealed to them as well. And of course, as the organization grew, initially it grew through ways of people who knew each other, neighbors, people in the same high school joining, people in the same community college, et cetera.
And would you say when some women were joining that kind of the, I guess, nebulous nature of women's role in the party allowed them to envision exactly what they would want to do within the party?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Now, initially, there was a category that was created called Pantherettes, right? Which it was the ideal that the men would be Panthers and the women would be Pantherettes, and that the Pantherettes would have their own kind of separate structure within the organization. So there would be a captain of the men and a captain of the women, for example. However, that structure quickly fell apart. And women were eventually incorporated just within the body of the organization.
Mm. Why did that structure fall apart?
I think that it was something that was not sustainable. I think that there was a sense of, first of all, just personnel, having enough people to fill all of those roles, you know, all of those parallel structures. And then I think it just soon became clear that the women just didn't want to be in their parallel structure. Now, at that time, there were many organizations in which women had a separate either a silo, or even if they weren't in a separate silo, they would oftentimes have their own interest group or subgroup within the larger group, et cetera. But Panther women never did develop anything like that. So the stream just eventually, the walls between those groups eventually just collapsed.
And what can be the downfall, if any, of kind of separating and creating those silos? Like what was, I guess we can maybe go back to the rigidity of the NOI. Mm-hmm. Like what were some of the issues with having those two separate structures?
There's not a lot in the literature about that. So I'm just speculating as versus speaking from the historical evidence that I've seen. But I would guess that just the relationship between the two entities, like who is really in charge, right? Is it that the men of the captain and women of the captain have this are co-equal? Or is it really that the male structure is always superseding the female structure that was there? Right? I guess that would be a question. So, you know, who where does the authority really lie? And is this parallel structure really a structure of equality, or is it separate and unequal, we can say? That was definitely, I think, probably part of the reason why, you know, there were those challenges there.
And just to go on a quick aside, and this is kind of a conversation that we've been having on our show as we're talking about Black History Month and as it pertains to women. As a professional historian, do you find it frequent and do you find it frustrating, like sort of not having the literature and evidence to answer some questions that might be there?
It is challenging. But I mean, I feel like, you know, it's always the moment in time. There are things that I wanted to know when I started my journey, as like I said, right after college, that I didn't think I would ever know, because at that point, the literature, you know, the evidence just was not there. But I was able to find evidence through oral histories or through people who passed away donating this or that to different libraries. So I feel like there's always, you know, the type of knowledge that we have is always potentially growing. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Because it's also potentially dying when people pass on and the stuff in their garages and basements just gets, you know, donated to Goodwill. Of, you know, with no one ascertaining their value. So, yeah, again, I got into this through autobiography. So I love reading people's story on their own terms, for them to tell me what it was like or something like that. I feel like those are the moments where you can kind of get a more unfiltered viewpoint. But, yes, it's difficult. I wish that there was more evidence about different elements of what happened to Panthers. And, of course, I'm only someone who is writing about one location. And the Panthers were eventually a nationwide organization with chapters all around the country. And how it was in Oakland was not how it was in other places as well. So just finding out those stories, I think, are important as well.
I wanted to talk a bit about, so when Black women did start joining the Black Panther Party, and there were recruitment efforts towards getting Black women in the party. You had mentioned, I saw you speak at Caveat, and you were doing a talk on women's roles in the Black Panther Party, and you had mentioned that in one specific, I guess maybe it was a newspaper ad, there was a line that said, "Jive sisters need not apply," or something along those lines.
Right, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the implications of that were? And what Jive means, because it's 2018 and folks might not know.
Yes. Well, the idea of Jive might be close to trifling as we think about it today. Just, you know, just no account, troublemaking, all of those the negatives that come along with the phrase. So in the back of one of the Panther newspapers was an advertisement saying that they needed typists to help them. Like I said, they were very, you know, on some levels, they were running an organization that was like a machine. So you needed, you know, note takers and typists and filers, and clerical work was all part of the Panther Revolution. It wasn't just, oh, let's get out there. They weren't just a mass-based movement or a movement around protest activity. They were also an organization entity as well. So they wanted typists to come in and work with them and volunteer. And it said on the advertisement, Jive sisters do not apply. And when I read that, I was like, wow, well, first of all, thinking about how work was gendered in that time, that when they're talking typists, okay, so now it's evident that they're thinking women are going to be the ones to have those particular skills. Two, it sounds like there was some kind of question mark or some sort of prior conflict, because why would you say that unless you had some prior conflict? So when you're saying Jive sisters need not apply, perhaps you're talking about someone's work ethic, but maybe you're talking about someone's general attitude to the work. And it was interesting because I was able to interview some women who joined the Panthers who started out as volunteers, community volunteers, before becoming full-time members. And many of them said, the ones that I interviewed said, you know, we didn't mind doing clerical work. It's just that we didn't want to be relegated solely to that work, right? And the ideal of that work being a skill that could be transferred. So you may come into an organization and you might be the only one who knows how to do the books, right? But at the end of your tenure, you've now taught that to everyone so that, you know, everyone can take on that role and see it as a role of value, as versus being the only person who knows how to do that, and that's all you ever do. So many of the women talked about wanting to contribute their skills to the organization happily, but not wanting to be relegated or limited to one particular type of role within the organization.
And were some of the women you talked to, were they just relegated to that role, or did they kind of branch out after contributing their
skill?
Many
of the women I talked to were able to branch out. And sometimes I think necessity was the mother of invention. I mean, the idea of the reality is that oftentimes everyone needed to do everything, or at least be able and willing to do some part of it. And I think because of that, because of the way the Panthers kind of evolved in motion, or they didn't have a lot of sort of self-assessment time because they were always under attack by the police and the FBI and those sorts of things, you know, you couldn't keep women back. It would just be like totally irrational. Now, that didn't mean that, you know, it was an egalitarian paradise either. But I think that those conditions did help fuel a sense of mobility around tasks.
I kind of wanted to know or ask, you know, do you know what the other recruitment tactics were besides advertisements in the Black Panther newspaper? For more context, I know that a lot of the women that first joined were young and were attracted because they were into activism or went to like a Black student union meeting at their local college and, you know, were attracted to the party in this way. Could you say or could you expound on, you know, if that kind of recruitment was gendered or was just kind of, or what other kinds of recruitment there were?
That's a great question. Now, they definitely did go to the local colleges and community colleges, four-year colleges. They went across the bay to San Francisco and did the same there. They talked to people who they call brothers on the block, meaning just you hanging out on the corner and you're talking and recruiting in that moment. They went to pool halls and recruited there, the bars, the local bars and neighborhood hangouts. But initially, you know, I would say that the women that came to them came from things like sources like the Movement for Black History and Black Studies at San Francisco State. So bringing women would join for those reasons. And I think, remember now that these are a bunch of 20-somethings. You know, maybe there was the initial idea of this is, you know, we're trying to attract men. But it soon became clear, of course, this is not just an organization where you're getting up and doing political work every day, but there's also a social element, right? And there was socializing as part of the Black Panther Party. And, you know, male-female socializing was a plus. You know, it made people sometimes look twice at the organization, right? You know, to imagine that this is an organization with not just one type of people, but with, you know, here are these men and women, right? It's like why they give, you know, they let women in the club for free before midnight.
Yeah.
Because, you know, once, you know, the sisters are in there, then other people will come. And there was the ideal of, well, this is a burgeoning social movement. And yeah, we've got all these brothers here, but we also want women in here as well. And so you have women joining from who are seasoned activists, student activists, women who are coming, you know, as they say, from the block or from the corner. as well as women coming from educational institutions, women that people knew. Oftentimes, you know, the reality is these community colleges were in communities, right? So the people who went to the community college may have gone to the high school together. And so they might know each other's brothers and sisters or that kind of thing. I think initially there was really a community wave movement, you know, how the Panthers grew.
So you mentioned like this was a party full of young 20-something people. Did, as kind of like visual icons within the Black Panther Party, did those people kind of arise? Like, were there like Black Panther heartthrobs?
Yes, definitely. And there was definitely sort of the politics of appearance at this time. I mean, it was an interesting time in terms of style and beauty culture. And the Panthers were on the cutting edge of that with the natural hairstyles and the, you know, the sort of a fresh appearance, an understanding that it wasn't just your appearance, but your knowledge and ability to talk about Fanon and Malcolm X and Che Guevara and, you know, and Mao Zedong. Like, that was the popular kids. You know, that was the conversation that made you into an icon, your intellectual knowledge. So you definitely have people like Kathleen becoming an icon. You know, on the one hand, of course, when you see the images of her, she's stunningly attractive, I think, by many registers of beauty. But it was also her toughness. I mean, she was a tough person. People talk about, you know, fearing that Kathleen was coming to town because she was going to be kind of reviewing your chapter. And you had to kind of come correct, and you had to show that you knew the lingo, the language, the, you know, the intellectual base and all of that as well. So you definitely have people like Kathleen Cleaver, I think, becoming very iconic as well. Anzo Davis, I think. Later on, Elaine Brown, Bobby Seale for sure. I mean, Bobby Seale was a stand-up comedian, and we don't really remember that.
I don't know that.
You know, but you could imagine that even you can even see it today. I mean, his personality, people love him. He has like this lovable personality. I'm not saying he may not be problematic on all of these different levels or whatever, but I'm just saying that he has the personality that was very charismatic and drew people to him. And he was funny, and that made him, that was an asset that he used, especially in terms of speaking to Black communities, right? Just being able to have that humor, have that delivery that was in tune with that kind of thing as well.
We definitely wanted to get more into Kathleen Cleaver a little bit later, but just for now, in terms of her being an icon, do you think, if at all, there was any sort of colorism that went into play with this extremely light-skinned Black Panther woman kind of becoming the heartthrob of the Black Panther Party as opposed to someone who might be darker skin?
Definitely. I mean, I think there was definitely that. It's also true that Kathleen was, of course, tied to Eldridge Cleaver, her husband, who was a Black Panther leader. And so, you know, the reality is that women who were tied to powerful men, on the one hand, oftentimes were lost in their shadow in some ways. Like, history remembers, like, Eldridge Cleaver's wife, the same way we may remember Dr. King's wife, but yet these people are, women are incredibly accomplished on their own right, right? They're leaders on their own right, but their associations kind of mute their power. On the other hand, because of that connection, I believe it amplified and gave them more power within the organization as well. So, yes, I definitely think that there was colorism. This was a time, however, I think that what I was also told is that there were times where the hair that might have been considered the good hair, quote unquote, in the past that was more loosely curled and things like that. I mean, people shared anxieties about getting that right afro, right? It was that, you know, if your hair was particularly the texture of it could easily get an afro, that was valued. And if you had that soft, curly sort of wave look that might have been considered the good hair before, now that was, you know, prized differently. That, you know, this was a time of really debating around aesthetics, that fuller lips were seen as somehow more authentic. I'm not saying that this was, they were able to upend the beauty hierarchy, which valued the closer to European you look, the, you know, the higher, more beautiful you were perceived. But I'm just saying that ideals about beauty weren't as simple as they once were. It wasn't just like, oh, Kathleen Cleaver, light-skinned black woman, she's automatically number one. It was like, oh, Kathleen has full lips and her afro is on point, you know, and it's, I don't want to use the term, but I think the term was used perhaps at the time, but it's nappy, you know, it's not curly. And this makes her even more beautiful. So I think it was kind of a complex time in terms of ideals about color and beauty for women.
So 3C sisters need not apply in terms of the hair section.
Right. 3C sisters have to work harder. So instead of people spending, you know, money on gels and incorporating all sorts of things into their routine to kind of loosen their hair and get that right out of the shower loaded with conditioner look, now you have the 3Cs, you know, in their corner talking about, well, I had to tease out and, yeah, you know, yeah, I had to do all these things to get, you know, to make my hair approximate this look. So it's kind of a shift at the time, I think, that doesn't get talked about enough.
Do you have any, is there any research that you've come across about the role of queer women in the party and maybe even like genderqueer people in the party as well as gay men in the party?
That's a good question. I feel like there's more research coming out about that now, which is kind of exciting. There's also research coming out about disability and how the Panthers were supporting disabled people, and how one of the Panthers who was disabled was sort of a liaison between the groups. So I feel like as the larger society is getting more and more aware and conscientized around these issues, the questions are being asked and then the answers are being found. So yes, I mean, within the organization, there were always people who were queer. However, what I was told is that women who had same-sex sexual relations with other women were received less, I guess we're more, I don't want to say tolerant, I want to say comfortable or, yeah, within the organization than men who had same-sex relationships, right? And I think that it goes to biases around lesbianism being quirky, interesting, sexy, you know, all of these things.
And then also closer to masculinity.
Right, and then close to masculinity under the male gaze, right? So it's that, that's interesting. Wow. You know, but not the same for men. At the same time, so Panther Erica Huggins is known currently as someone who was very expressive around her sexuality. She had relationships with men and women while she was within the organization. And she said so, you know, on the record. She was married to a man. She then had relationships with women, et cetera, while she was a member of the organization, much of which was an open secret in that it was not per se discussed. It was just out there. Now, because, like I said, she was a well-known leader and she was connected to John Huggins, her husband, who had been killed and martyred. So I can't say that your average Panther woman had that same experience or felt that same sense of freedom in terms of, or even had all of those options, let's put it that way, as an Erica Huggins. But I can say that there have definitely been people who have said that, you know, within the organization, there was this sense that that queer people found a home and were not outed or demonized for their sexual choices while members of the organization. There have been new literature that looked at how the Panthers in the 70s have connected themselves and been supported by LGBTQ organizations. So when Bobby Seale and Elaine Brown were running for office in the 70s, there was a group called Gays for Bobby and Elaine, right, that supported them. So they were seen as kind of generally supportive. That didn't mean that within the organization there was not like a strong strain of homophobia, especially I would say around the question of against men. And because, of course, there's a very well-known memo that Huey Newton, when he came out of prison, he issued a statement that the Panthers should stop using negative words, demonizing men for, in the eyes of their critics, exhibiting behaviors that were weak and were feminine and those kinds of things, that they shouldn't use words that call their enemies those negative terms, right? They should try to scrub those terms from their vocabulary, et cetera, et cetera.
So in regards to this memo that Huey Newton sent out, was there any sort of accountability after the fact? Like, did people saying these kinds of homophobic things or maybe treating members of the party differently because they were gay, was there any alleviation of that?
It's hard to tell. I don't have any evidence of that. I do know that after the memo that he wrote was utilized by the FBI to sow the seeds of dissent within the organization. So they create a lot of fake letters critiquing Huey Newton for even uttering such a thing and saying it was, the letter was about both the gay and lesbian liberation movement and the use of terminology and language within the party, as well as the women's movement. So they were fake letters generated that were basically saying, oh, Huey's out of touch, blah, 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 blah. Now he wants us to relate to the women and the gays and all of that. So the moment of him issuing that directive was also connected to internal dissent, which was manufactured by the FBI. So it's hard to tell exactly what happened in actuality within. But I'm hoping that, again, that this becomes something that a new generation of scholars can delve into more deeply, because we've had the memo forever, and now there are increasingly books that are talking about these interconnections. So I would love to just see more being done with that.
I kind of want to segue into like what was real and what wasn't real in regards to the history of the Black Panther with what the FBI was doing. Mm-hmm. When Elaine Brown became the first and only, I guess, chairman or chairperson of the Black Panther Party, it was because Huey Newton had to step down and go into exile because he was, charged with killing a sex worker.
Right.
What was that? Did he actually do that? Do we know?
Right. Now, this is the hard thing to ascertain. Now, he was certainly accused of it. He was also accused of pistol whipping a tailor at the time. It's hard to know what actually happened because folks are leery of putting things in the record and things like that. We know for sure that there were people who were harmed in that way. Now, was he responsible for it, or what role he played? It remains unclear.
What do you mean by people were harmed in that way?
Well, there was someone who was pistol whipped by someone.
By someone. Yeah.
And then there was someone who was killed, you know, who lost their life.
And do we even know if that was committed by someone of the Black Panther Party?
We don't.
Wow.
We don't. And I think that, you know, this is how the repression has worked. It's that certainly within the organization, there were excesses. There were people who engaged in illegal activity. There were people who broke the rules. There were people who abused women and other people who that they had power over. Right. I mean, all of these things happened. they happen in the context of this larger fishbowl of political repression, which sometimes made people close ranks about outing and addressing some of those weaknesses and some of those excesses and some of those illegalities that were there at the time. So it's difficult to, you know, it's difficult to kind of get in there and figure all of that out, especially with people not wanting to implicate themselves and others and all of that.
And is there a conversation, a clearer conversation that can be had around Eldridge Cleaver and his, I guess, history of misogyny towards both Black women and white women, which he documented in his book?
I think the Eldridge Cleaver conversation is deeply underdeveloped because it's really an interesting phenomenon with Eldridge Cleaver in that he has written quite a few things about women's liberation, et cetera, that were printed in the Panther newspaper. At the same time, it's clear that his personal practice was very different than the ideals that he put out there. You know, and this was not uncommon at the time. Men who would publicly proclaim one thing, but when you got them behind closed doors, it was a whole other, you know, they were not living out the ideals that they were putting out in the public.
And just to be clear, what kinds of ways was Eldridge not? I guess,
well,
how was he abusing
women? Eldridge Cleaver was, well, although Kathleen Cleaver's biography is not out there yet, so it's hard to, I mean, she, I think it's her story to tell in some ways. You know, the intimacies and the context. However, it's fairly well known that she was in an abusive relationship with him, and he, you know, would assault her, hit her, beat her in ways that other people could visibly see. What does this mean in terms of their, in terms of how we understand Eldridge Cleaver as a leader of the organization? Certainly, we talked earlier about Kathleen Cleaver's complexion, right? Hard to hide those kinds of altercations and the scars, you know, internal and external, that they may leave on your body, on one's body. So what did this mean for her to be this well-respected? Like I said, she was known for being tough. What does it mean to be this well-respected Panther leader and have this going on in your quote-unquote personal life? Your quote-unquote personal life is not really personal, because your personal life is your political life as well, right? And of course, there are many people, as we know, navigating that very same, you know, contradiction crisis, you know, in contemporary society of, you know, hiding the impact abuse on their lives. As they go around, and, you know, and everyone feels they're competent, and never her, you know, I would never expect that from her, about her, et cetera, or about him. So, I mean, I think that was part of the reality with Eldridge Cleaver. There was his private, or the things that happened that maybe were unremarked about in a collective way that was censured. Interestingly enough, I point out in my book that it wasn't until the Panthers broke with Eldridge Cleaver that they publicly denounced his marriage to Kathleen. If you look at the Panther newspaper, you'll see that after Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver have a falling out, the very next few issues of the Panther newspaper contain information like, Kathleen Cleaver is being held hostage by Eldridge Cleaver. She doesn't have freedom of movement. And these kinds of things, which were certainly obviously known beforehand, right? So all of this to say, you know, just seeing how abuse kind of operates and gets perpetrated within this organization. I think Eldridge Cleaver, because of his transparency around his mentality in his book, which despite those declarations, was considered like one of the key texts for revolutionaries at the time period. I mean, Soul on Ice was like on everyone's reading list.
And just to be clear, what kinds of things, what kind of open declarations was he saying in Soul on Ice?
Well, in the book, he talks about raping black women and raping white women. And that book was the darling of not just the African-American community, but he was seen as a literary genius by many elements of the white left. And in fact, Soul on Ice, even though it's probably less popularized, I would say, today in classrooms, but it was definitely seen in my day as sort of great literature, something to read to understand the black condition in the 60s, despite its very violent, misogynist overtones and undertones that are so evident to us today.
Was there any sort of reconciliation with that? Like, the people who were lauding it as this great activist text, were they just skirting over that fact, or...
Yeah, it's almost like one would imagine today with someone in the Oval Office talking about grabbing women, you know, in a particular way. Everyone heard it, and they just excuse it with whatever excuses they say, or they condemn it, but not in a way that has any impact on the person, and we all move on. I think it was that kind of thing in some smaller way with Eldridge Cleaver. Now, there were examples. For example, I read that one of the Panther chapters, this is the great thing about local history, some of the scholars who are working on the local Panther chapters, one particular chapter, I want to say it was maybe in Milwaukee, wrote into the national headquarters, because Soul on Ice was on the Panther reading list that went out to all the chapters. And they wrote into the national headquarters, somehow protested that they weren't going to be reading that book because of the sexism in it. So I know that there were some elements of pushback. And as we get the local histories more, we may see more of that. But I don't think that those self-revelations that he made in his own book that was widely read, or the open secrets around the type of violence that was there and his interpersonal relationships, I don't think that those things derailed his political trajectory. You know, he ascended to the Panther leadership. He is remembered as one of the great Panther leaders, et cetera. Even though, of course, you know, unlike many, he passed fairly soon after the end of the 60s, and he became a born-again Christian and a conservative as well, whereas many Panthers remain, you know, adherents of radical politics.
Very interesting turn. You've talked briefly about the, you know, domestic violence between the Cleavers. Was there any other violence against women in the party? In your book, you talked a bit about a time where there was physical discipline used on party members. So could you elaborate on things that occurred to women in the party?
Right. I definitely think, and again, I remember I'm looking only at Oakland. Mm-hmm. I definitely think that there were women who experienced physical violence and punishment within the context of the organization. This was also true for men. And it was oftentimes something, again, that was accepted. Right? Just the same way that someone, let's say, if they're pledging a sorority or fraternity, might accept there's some kind of violence that they're going to be facing. Or if they are going into the military and going through basic training, they may accept that they may be corrected or redirected in ways that inflict pain. Those were the understandings when you were part of the organization. And the challenge happens when you are someone who has called out sexism within the organization, and you're being punished for that. You're not being punished because you broke a rule. You're not being punished because of, you know, the way your actions may have impacted the, you know, the group in a global sense. You're being punished now for speaking out against sexism, for challenging a leader's authority, for example, for stepping out of place in some other ways as well. So it was really clear that there were elements and there were times within the Panthers' history where the type of discipline of punishment that operated within the organization was unfairly trained upon women to the point of, you know, physical violence, you know, beatdowns, we can say, people endured. And I think this is one of the ugly parts of, you know, what I was saying earlier, which is the Panthers were a disciplined organization. And you'll see that towards the end of my book, I talk about how when people left the organization, they talked about wanting to be corrected with love and in a way that builds them up as a person as versus tears them down. What people don't understand is that people gave their all to the Black Panther Party, sometimes leaving their family, living with party members, marrying the party members, raising their kids in the school. So to be cast out was not just like I'm losing my job, quote unquote, but it's like literally you're losing everything, your network and everything like that. And so all of those things made people willing to endure, you know, these types of things until they couldn't anymore. So you have stories like the Erica Huggins, even the Elaine Brown, who tells stories of departure from the organization and conjoined with fear of violence, fear of what was going to happen to their bodies, those kinds of things that we would not necessarily expect from like, oh, I'm leaving the NAACP, you know what I mean? So, I mean, that was part of the ugly reality of the organization.
Can we talk a little bit about Elaine Brown's run as chairperson of the party and what sort of led to that and also the implications of several of the male leaders being arrested and jailed and how women kind of came to fruition in administrative roles?
Right. Well, Elaine Brown ascended to leadership of the organization when Huey Newton went into exile. She was somebody who was... who came out of the Panthers in Los Angeles. She had this history of activism. She brought a particular skill set to the position, and she's really known as helping to formalize women's roles as leaders within the central governing body within the Black Panther Party as an organization. Under her leadership, the Panthers definitely developed their community programs, particularly their school. They were able to apply for funding from the local government, as well as national entities for the school. And they were also able to run pretty successful election campaigns for some of the local poverty program offices, to school boards, et cetera, et cetera. The Panthers were definitely trying to focus on local power and community organizing under her leadership. In her own autobiography, A Taste of Power, she also details how she wanted to develop the Panthers' informal structures as well, in ways that would benefit, you know, and strengthen her leadership. And I think, you know, you kind of get the balance of both of those things when you read her book.
I think we can kind of wrap it up there. That was extremely informative. Thank you so much. If you could tell our listeners where they can, I don't know.
Find
how do,
you.
Yeah, how do you like to be accessed, if at all, as a historian, like on the web?
I am online. I'm at www.robincspencer.com. That's R-O-B-Y-N-C Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R.com. So you can find me at www.robincspencer.com. You can buy the book online through Amazon, through barnesandnoble.com. You can also go to your favorite brick and mortar bookstore, especially I love black owned bookstores, women's bookstores, queer bookstores, just anything we can do to sort of help support those entities in our community. They're also available there, and you can also have them order my book to bring in there if it's not already in those spaces as well. So there's lots of ways to find out more information about me or the book, which is called The Revolution Has Come, Black Power, Gender, and the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. So I look forward to any outreach or feedback from anyone listening. And always remember your history.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Inner Ho Uprising. Hope you enjoyed that, and hope you're enjoying this Black History Month infused with sex and sexuality and gender thing that we're doing here for this month. And if you hate it, just say, shut the hell up. Stop talking about these things. We don't like this. But people seem to really enjoy the OGs of Me Too. And hopefully you enjoy this. And hopefully you enjoy the two other episodes we have in store for you. This is really cool. I like doing it.
Do you like doing it?
Cool? I love doing it. Yeah. Yeah.
Best Black History Month I've had.
Yay.
Learning stuff.
Which exactly. is sad. Which hasn't happened in years.
Exactly. Decades of schooling. This is my first Black History Month learning.
Just like George Washington Carver, the peanut, over and over and over again.
Literally.
And that guy with the stoplight, Garrett.
Garrett Morgan. I was going to call him George. I wasn't even learning then. Oh, gosh.
George Morgan.
Which is horrible because the only woman they would ever mention is Madam C.J. Walker.
Yeah.
Love her, but yeah. We're finding out there's other women making history.
Dun, dun, dun. What a surprise.
So if you guys would like to follow us on social media, you can do so by following at Inner Ho Uprising without the G on Twitter, at Inner Ho Uprising on Instagram and Facebook with the G, and go to innerhouprising.com to pay a bitch and check out merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
You guys can follow me, Aku, at HEYYAKUAGIRL at Hey A Cool Girl on Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter.
And you can find me at SlamRid on Instagram and Twitter, and fuck Snapchat, or at least that's what everybody else is saying. I deleted that months ago. Bye.
Bye.